You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Veterans Day is close at hand, so we're taking this opportunity to sit down with a couple of America's longest-living veterans, men who fought in World War II. Guy Stern is 96. As a teenager, he got out of Nazi Germany, came to America, and then he wound up serving in the U.S. Army as World War II broke out, where he rose to the rank of Master Sergeant. He landed in Normandy around the time of D-Day as part of a group called the Ritchie Boys. It was a special military intelligence unit made up of Germans, Austrians, and Czechs who had fled Nazi Germany, most of them Jewish. His assignment, interrogate German prisoners. And yes, he did lose his family during the war. Eventually, he came to Wayne State University, where he was a distinguished professor of German literature and cultural history, and he served as provost. He's still active at the Holocaust Memorial Center in Oakland County. Guy Stern, welcome back to Stateside.
Good to see you. Thank you for your welcome.
It's so good to have you here. And we are so happy to welcome Art Holst, also 96. He, too, served in the U.S. Army. He rolled into Germany with General George Patton's Third Army. Art rose to the rank of captain, so Guy had to salute Art today as we came in. A couple of notable moments. A German officer surrendered himself and his 600 men to Art, and Art offered one German prisoner the chance to serve out the war as his interpreter or be put in a POW camp. The German chose translator, and in the 1980s, Art visited Germany and had a reunion with his former prisoner. After the war, Art went on to become a referee in the NFL, and he officiated in Super Bowls VI and XII. Art Holst, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much, Cindy. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Great to have you here. So,
and a pleasure to be with Guy.
Yes, I know you've crossed.
I may have had more rank, but he's 3 months my senior in age. He's smarter.
So here we are, coming up on another Veterans Day. Both of you, well into your 90s, you stop and you realize that World War II ended more than 73 years ago. In all those years since the war, what moment comes to mind that you still remember like it was yesterday? Guy, I'll have you start.
Yes, there are many memorable moments. And there are sometimes moments where the war seems to stand still. And that came right after the invasion. I was ordered to go ashore on D+3. And about a month later, we were still in Normandy because our advance had slowed down. Our tanks were stopped. We were stopped. And then a curious thing happened. Our captain said, all Jewish personnel come to the command tent at 1800 hours. We have gotten some bad news. One of our MPs just got the notice that his wife died in childbirth in Brooklyn. And so the chaplain is coming down here to have the Jewish commemoration and the Jewish prayers for the dead. And so we assembled. In 1 month, you become a fairly hardened soldier. So we all assembled there, and the chaplain invoked the prayers for the dead and for the living. And the war, for one moment, stood absolutely still. And I felt, here we are assembled and we are crying over a woman we had never seen, over the wife of an MP who we slightly knew, and we were praying. And that is a moment which became unforgettable in the horrors of war.
That is special, and that I think most of us would not have expected you to say that, and what a beautiful moment that was. Art, what's your moment that seems like it just happened?
Well, there are many, many, Cindy, but one that came to my mind first, so I've got to tell you this. How did the war end for me? Well, we were in southern Germany. I finished the war just 1 mile from the Austrian border. And we were staying in a railroad car. The Third Army didn't dig foxholes. General Patton said, they dig foxholes, we attack. So we were staying in a boxcar on May the 8th, 1945. And it came out, and a B-17 came over, but instead of being at 17,000 feet, he wasn't at 10,000, he wasn't at 5,000, he was about 2,000 feet. And immediately, I thought, this guy's been shot up, and I hope he's dropped his bomb load. And I looked up, and sure enough, the bomb bay doors came open, and out came what I thought were bombs. They exploded in the air, and out came thousands of leaflets. And there was a little German boy about 8 years old standing there, and he was begging me for chocolate or kaugummi, that's chocolate or chewing gum. I said, gehen Sie ganz schnell und bringen Sie mir ein Papier für Schokolade, in my poor, poor German. I knew a few words. And he took off and ran and brought it back. I looked at it, and it said, the war is over at 11 a.m. or 9 a.m., no more shooting. It's the end of the war. I was thrilled, of course, but I had men out there, and you have no idea what happens at the end of the war. It's celebrations in New York and all that stuff. 350,000 plus Germans surrendered on the same day.
Wow.
And you're responsible for their medical care, their hospital care, their food, their housing, everything. It was a mess. But that sticks out in my mind because as I looked up into that nice blue sky and saw this bomber, I thought those poor guys are going to get it. And it was entirely different. It was how I knew that that was, as we called it, VE Day.
And when that bomber's door went open and those leaflets started tumbling out, these leaflets, in a supplemental way, part of our responsibility as intelligence personnel. So we were asked to test the effectiveness of these leaflets by criticizing them. One leaflet I have as a model of good psychology in my mind. One of my comrades had suggested it. It was a pass for a prisoner to show to an American soldier, which showed that this was a leaflet guaranteeing decent food, decent quarters, decent treatment, and the most brilliant idea was to have it signed by Dwight D. Eisenhower. And this played very intelligently to the psychology of the Germans. If they saw a document like that, that is a leaflet they dared to keep in their pockets. And those, I think, Art, were the ones you were talking about.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And whoever designed that deserved commendation for it, because regaining the trust of the Germans was a challenge.
What about a person? What about one person that maybe you served with or you met during your time fighting in Europe that you just can't seem to forget?
I would think the person that sticks out for me was our commanding captain, Captain Kahn, who came also from Germany and was in charge of our whole intelligence operation. And he was such an understanding and excellent leader that we almost forgot that we had one before him who was equally excellent and a completely different personality. His name was Captain Rust, and he came from Texas. And the most memorable moment with Captain Rust was when he called me over and he said, Sergeant Stern, this is an interrogation for you. You are the only one who has as a skill Spanish as well as German and French. So I have here three Spaniards who took part in the Spanish Civil War, escaped to France, were simply overtaken again by the Germans, and were sent to the Channel Islands to install the fortifications if we ever took a chance of liberating these islands from the German occupation. So I told them in halting Spanish, I must admit, that I was to interrogate them about the fortifications of these islands. I never had military Spanish, and they said, just give us some writing materials and we'll take over. And they did beautiful maps of all the fortification from a machine gun nest
to an artillery position. I brought that in, and Captain Rust looked at me and he said, "Sergeant Stern, that is a heck of a good interrogation."
You did well.
And I said, "Thank you, sir."
What about you, Art? Who's the person
two,
you
two
can't
people.
Forget? All right.
Basic training. Sparta, Wisconsin. Our second lieutenant. He was overweight, was not in shape. And he would yell at us and scream at us. "You do something wrong." He said, "Get down there and duck waddle." And he'd make us waddle like a duck till we were ready to drop over some minor thing. And I came away from that thinking, if I ever get to be an officer, I am not going to be like him. I've always said that everybody has value. If nothing else, you can serve as a bad example. And he did. And so in my training days, I used that. If I had a man, I said, "Give me 50 push-ups." But I got down and did 50 with him and then did more. And I learned that from that one experience.
That one bad officer.
The second man that sticks out of my mind is Sergeant Karl Steinmesser of the German Wehrmacht. He was the man I had captured. I won't go into that, but made him my interpreter. And we were together for 5 months. I got him out of the Army in July. In July, I said, "Carl, you got to go out. I'm taking the prison camp." "Oh, no, Lieutenant." I said, "Yep, tomorrow morning." And we had a prison camp at the airport in Bad Aibling, Germany, and about 50,000 prisoners on it. Walked in there, and the major said, I said, "I've got a prisoner of war." He said, "Where's he been?" I said, "I kept his interpreter." He said, "I never heard of such a thing." I said, "Neither did I, but I did it." I said, "I'd like to have him out as quick as possible." And he said, "How soon?" I said, "Noon." He threw his pen down his desk. He said, "We've been in a blankety-blank war, Lieutenant." I said, "I know I've been in it." But I said, he understands the railroad, and he speaks English. It's a big help to me. And he got me out at 1 o'clock. So I said, "Carl, you're free to leave." He said, "I'll stick with you, Lieutenant. Stick with me for those months." And then in 1985, I went to Europe, as you mentioned, and met him again with his wife, talked about, reflected on the war. Those two events probably stick out more to me. The rest of it was just kind of a maelstrom, and seeing Dachau, which you
mm-hmm.
mentioned.
You yeah. saw Dachau, yes. If you just joined us, we are talking with two World War II veterans, Dr. Guy Stern and Art Holst. Both of them served in the United States Army in Europe, in the European theater during World War II. There have been so many movies, television shows, and books, and novels, and documentaries about World War II over these last seven decades. What do you, as you watch them, what do you think gets missed?
I guess about the war is the single details. And that leads to a movie I just thought about. It's called A Walk in the Sun. And it's about a company taking a farmhouse in Italy. But what goes on in the minds of these soldiers is depicted through their conversations. That detail of how we feel, that is one of the rare things that a movie can do if the directing is good. And the imagination of this director was to have an African-American singer sing a sort of ballad of the undertaking of that platoon.
Yes. I want to switch gears here, thinking about the decades that have passed in America since the war ended in 1945. And here we are in 2018. We have a lot of divisions in our American society, a lot of people who feel left out. They feel left behind, that they didn't get their shot at the American dream. Are we where you thought we would be as a country when you were able to lay down your weapons in 1945?
Yes. I remember frequently, you know, especially when you were in a camp or were in a bivouac, you were woken up and you took your oath of allegiance to the United States. At that time, we said, one nation, indivisible. And I think as the politicians of the past, there was an opposition to the party in power. But when it came here in Michigan, when the war started, Senator Vandenberg, a convinced opponent to Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal,
yep.
he wrote a letter to Franklin D. Roosevelt, and he said,
accept this letter as an olive branch now that we are in war. And then later on, he wrote another letter to FDR, and he said, Mr. President, partisanship stops at the water's end.
But then the
water's edge.
But here we are. That was a sentiment expressed then. Here we are, where partisanship is probably as deep as it's ever been in American history.
Yes, and I consider myself an American patriot, and I think of the moment when this vow of allegiance we took, one nation, indivisible, will become a reality again, when the issue is the whole country and all our citizens.
So well spoken, Guy, absolutely. And when you think about it, as a commander, you have no choice. You can't fire him. You have no choice of who serves with you. You have to take these men and figure out what the strengths are of each guy, because your life depends on him, and his life can depend on you. He may be somebody you would have never associated with, but you need to do it. I cannot understand for the life of me, once an election is passed and we have a president, you can differ on policy, but you can find ways to get together. I used to meet, I'm a Republican, I used to meet with a Democrat who was completely opposite from me. We were great friends and stayed great friends, and we would argue very, very loudly. We met on a Friday news, and one Friday noon I said, we're going to meet Friday, I said, let's take one problem and see what we could come up with as a Republican and Democrat. You're in Congress on one side, I'm in Congress on the other. In an hour and a half, we had a bill on Social Security that I would present today. And I said, why can't they do this? Because once we have an election, we are all, as he said, one nation under God.
Art Holst and Guy Stern will be part of the fourth annual Stories of Service. This happens every year to benefit Fisher House, Michigan, and it'll be at Hill Auditorium November 5th from 7 to 9 p.m. You can get all the details by going to fisherhousemichigan.org. Art Holst, Guy Stern, we thank you both for your service, and we thank you for being with us today on Stateside.
My pleasure, and I'm sure his too.
Yes, it was a great interview because of our master of ceremonies.